free. Oh, let it.
Hi,
I'm Mayor Ed Koch, and when I'm up at night making all the tough decisions that it takes to keep this city going, I get my inspiration from Dano's Late Show on the radio on 102.7 WNEW FM in New York. Book 'em, Dano.
Welcome to the Bronx Nostalgia Hour. From NPR News, I'm Ron Elving.
I'm Ken Reardon. I had to bring in that from one of my cassettes from 1980.
Was it an 8-track?
I know. No, cassettes are not 8-tracks. There's a difference.
8-track and cassette? Oh, I guess it was 8-track and cassette, not 8-track cassette.
It was or.
8-track or cassette.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, you had a choice back then.
That's right.
Unless, of course, you lived in New York, in which case you had Ed Koch and no choice.
There was no choice. Well, Ed Koch passed away last Friday at the age of 88, and we'll talk about him later in the podcast.
We will wait until later in the podcast to fulfill that. But, Ken, in the meantime, I do think we need to talk about the state of this union of ours.
And, Ron, what is the State of the Union?
The State of the Union is sound. I think the podcast remains about as
unsound
as it has ever been. And the president is coming out to deliver his fourth State of the Union. And let's get this over with right now. The first State of the Union sort of address that he gave back in 2009 was not actually a State of the Union, but just an address to Congress.
Right, and that was the one famously responded to by Republican Bobby Jindal, who everybody said at the time, because it was not the greatest response in the world, that was going to end his presidential aspirations.
Huh. Now, well, we didn't know what happened to that.
Well, right, because he hasn't been president since.
That's correct. And more recently, of course, the Republican response to the State of the Union was given by Paul Ryan in the year that he became the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party. So who has the big privilege this year, Ken?
It is Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, very popular. A lot of talk about 2016 with Marco Rubio. And clearly, there's a lot on his shoulders as he replies to the president's State of the Union address. And he's been doing a lot of work preparing for it.
I don't know. I think the Tupac's lyrics were probably more insightful, in my opinion, with all apologies to the Biggie fans. And I kind of grew up in that era. Right around the time that he had kind of gone to the West Coast style. He's from the East Coast, but right around the time he had gone out to California and joined Death Row, and they were doing, you know, it was like the peak of Death Row music is kind of when, you know, I was in college and then law school. So I don't know. I just thought it was better.
And that, of course, was from an interview that Ben Smith of BuzzFeed did with Marco Rubio this past week. But, you know, I have to go with him on that. I've always been much more of a Tupac guy than a Biggie.
Well, you've...
But you were more of a Biggie.
That's true, Ron. I understand you've gotten a lot of financial contributions from your Tupac.
That's absolutely right.
I just want to say, though, that I think the fact that he's talking about Tupac versus Biggie, I think it could be a big boost for his career. Because I remember when you and I started this podcast, we had that debate between Cowsills and Herman's Hermits.
That's right.
That was the new rage.
I was Herman's Hermits. I want
were
that
you? I was Cowsills.
You were Cowsills. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We kid, Marco. But, you know, he is really breaking through to another generation of people who are never going to vote Republican.
Well, you know something? He is certainly addressing issues involving groups that do not currently vote Republicans, and that's Latino voters. He's been out front on the Republican side on this immigration overhaul, the change in the way we allow immigrants to stay in the country and the path to citizenship. He's also taking some heat from certainly House members who are once again talking about amnesty and things like that. And who knows who is going to control the Republican Party in 2016. Of course, we have this new Karl Rove group that's talking about affecting the choices right away. But
Conservative Victory Project.
Exactly. Right. But, I mean, we don't know who's going to be controlling the nominating process. Well, it'll be the new Ron Paul folks who have taken over some state parties. But Marco Rubio is breaking away from that Tea Party role that elected him in 2010. And it's either courageous or certainly risky.
Yes, it is risky. But the interesting thing is that the party hierarchy is still with Marco, and they still see him as their best answerer to the president after the State of the Union. Now, let's also put it on the record that the Republicans do not want to call this the Republican response to the State of the Union. They want it to be called the Republican address to the nation, not a response to the president, but the Republican address to the nation. All right, now we have said that. The Republican response is going to be given by Marco this year, and he is saying, in essence, what? We're the party that wants you to. We're just as accepting to Hispanics who are in the country, whether they're here legally for several generations or whether they're more recent arrivals whom we can now embrace. And that's quite a different message than is going to be coming from some other elements of the Republican Party, including some of the other Hispanics in the Republican Party, like Raul Labrador from Idaho, who's a Republican congressman. And he had this to say on our own NPR Morning Edition this week.
The people that came here illegally knowingly, I don't think they should have a path to citizenship. If you knowingly violated our law, you violated our sovereignty, I think we should normalize your status, but we should not give you a pathway to citizenship.
Now, there really is a debate going on here in the Republican Party over this, where in the Senate, guys like Marco Rubio and John McCain and Lindsey Graham are willing to say, hey, it's time, let's figure out a way for these people to be citizens. And then you've got the House, where it doesn't seem to be quite so much, where they think maybe a visa is enough, legal status is enough, don't let them become citizens because then they might vote and because then we would be disrespecting all those people waiting in line somewhere else to get in legally.
And that's not the only split in the Republican Party, not just between the House and the Senate, but there is an ideological split that we've seen in the past. We've seen it with Rockefeller and Goldwater. We saw it with Eisenhower and Taft in 52. We saw it with
Eisenhower. In Taft in 52.
Yes, and the Cowsills. And of course, Reagan and Ford in 76. The point is, this split is being blamed by many in the party for losing Senate opportunities. Like, no better example, Todd Akin in Missouri in 2012, Richard Murdoch in Indiana, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware in 2010, people who have been so far to the right that they had no chance of winning the general election.
Was it because they were so far to the right? Or was it because they said one or two things that were wrapped around their neck and that strangled them?
Well, it's both. I mean, certainly both. Obviously, Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch had very unfortunate comments about rape that somehow the Republican Party doesn't seem to know how to deal with. At least these candidates didn't know how to deal with. And while Christine O'Donnell in Delaware easily beat Mike Castle, the establishment choice, she did get into this fix about masturbation and witchcraft and things like that that just made her campaign a complete...
Which I think it's fair to say. I mean, I don't think Christine O'Donnell was ever going to be able to win the state of Delaware.
Did you think she'd win the primary?
I didn't think she'd win the primary because I thought more of Mike Castle's voters would bother to come out, but they didn't.
Right.
They didn't show up and hers did. But she was pounced on by everybody in our business, everybody in the media saying, hey, what's the stuff you used to say about witchcraft and so on? So she never really had a chance
to be taken
seriously.
Don't blame the media, though. She said some crazy stuff.
Well, in the media, and that was immediately so prominent in terms of the coverage of her campaign. There was no chance for her. But I'm just saying, is it possible that absent one remark by Todd Akin, one remark that then prompted what Richard Murdoch said and some other candidates as well, that some of these people might very well have been successful. They might have won. It was not necessarily a thorough comparison of ideology that was going on so much as some gaffes on their part that did them in. But this is what has given rise to Karl Rove's Conservative Victory Project, which is coming out of his American Crossroads and American Crossroads GPS organizations that gave, you know, well over $100 million to some Senate candidates last time, and they didn't win. They didn't win even in places where they didn't make these gaffes and where they weren't necessarily ideologically off the mainstream.
Well, see, that's the argument some conservatives are making against the Karl Rove proponents, where they say, well, yes, you can point to the Todd Akins and the Richard Murdochs, the undisciplined candidates who made off-script remarks that hurt them. But what about the Tommy Thompsons in Wisconsin? What about the Heather Wilsons in New Mexico?
Or Linda Lingle in
Hawaii. Linda Lingle, you know, exactly, though. Rick Berg in North Dakota, Denny Rehberg in Montana. These candidates were not considered right-wing crazies. Most of them were backed by almost every Republican, and they lost, too. So you can't make the argument that the way for Republicans to win is to have the most moderate candidates, because moderates took a beating in 2012 as well. So we don't even know if the whole Republican name and brand was at fault in 2012 and not just a right-wing candidate or an establishment candidate.
But where in all of this is Eric Cantor? Here's the guy who wants to be the Speaker of the House, who's this far behind John Boehner in every picture of John Boehner, and who's, you know, turning up the heat on him all the time. He went out this week, had a very public kind of I want to be paid attention to moment going to the American Enterprise Institute and doing a lot of media interviews with that to say, I'd like to lay out a sort of kinder, gentler, softer demeanor for the Republican Party, even though I'm generally seen as such a hardliner.
I mean, let's face it. It's gotten a lot tougher to raise a family in America. And our goal has got to be to eliminate this doubt gripping our nation's families and to restore their hope and confidence so that they, the parents, can once again see a better tomorrow for their children.
Which leads to questions that some Republicans think that the answer is just, you know, if you give it a little smile, if the reason Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama is because Barack Obama had a winning personality, if you buy that argument, then the Republican Party doesn't have to change its ideology at all. It just has to present its message with more of a smile. Bob Dole was scowling, but George W. Bush was more likable. If you buy that argument, then it's all about the presentation and not the philosophy.
I think that was part of what Eric Cantor was saying, but I believe there were also a couple of issues on which he was, you know, showing a little ankle, at least offering to compromise a little bit. For example, the DREAM Act, which he voted against last time around, which has to do with people who were brought here illegally by their parents but who were juveniles at the time and now have, you know, gone to college, have clean records, maybe served
military.
In the military. And he voted against that when it was up as, quote, the DREAM Act in the last Congress. But
as
now,
most Republicans did.
Almost all. And now he's coming around and saying maybe that wasn't such a bad idea. Maybe we could let those people who did not willingly, deliberately, consciously break the law have a path to citizenship, which of course also implies those who did willingly come in the country knowing that our laws would exclude them, those people shouldn't have a path to citizenship.
Well, look, obviously everybody looked at the 2012 results, and maybe not so much 2010, but they looked at 2012. They looked at the numbers of Latino voters supporting Democratic candidates led by Barack Obama, and they think, well, maybe this is the beginning of the evolution of the Republican Party towards the kind of big tent that both President Reagan and George W. Bush espoused when they were running for office, opening up to Latino voters.
Okay, so a lot of talk about immigration in Washington this week, but also a lot of talk about some other issues that we don't always get into so much in the podcast because, well, they're national security and it requires a certain amount of expertise.
And it's important to Americans.
So we would normally shy from that kind of a subject. But in this particular instance, it has a very heavy political overtone, and that would be the nominations of Chuck Hagel to be the Secretary of Defense and John Brennan to be the new CIA director, which were on the griddle this week because we still have a lot of questions about Chuck Hagel. The Senate Armed Services Committee was going to vote on him this week but delayed it so that more information could be provided to some of the Republican members. And John Brennan had his hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Well, let's just quickly about Hagel. While there is sizable Republican opposition, I have not heard one single Democrat who said they're thinking of voting against him.
So not one.
If you add 55 Democrats, you also have Thad Cochran and Mike Johanns of Nebraska. That's 57 right there. Unless there's a filibuster,
yes.
And John McCain says he's not inclined to have a filibuster, and I don't think...
Who's going to filibuster?
Nobody, I don't think.
We do have Ted Cruz, the new senator from Texas, who says he wants to think about having a hold on this nomination, and I believe maybe one or two others have said they might want to have a hold on it, but I have not seen anybody come out and actually say they were going to filibuster. Now, the hold really isn't that big a deal unless it's backed up by a realistic threat to filibuster, and that's what we're still waiting to see.
On the other side, regarding the Brennan nomination, there was also some indications that Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, has talked about perhaps either filibustering or holding up the John Brennan nomination because Ron Wyden and many senators want more answers from the administration about what the policy is towards the drones and the indiscriminate use of drones in places like Pakistan, Yemen. And for a president who came into office blasting President Bush on waterboarding and torture and promising a very transparent administration, there have been a lot of secrets kept about what entitles the government, what entitles the Obama administration to take actions, as in killing American citizens overseas if they are involved in al-Qaeda activities.
That's right. Now, there have been a few Americans who were apparently inside the al-Qaeda operation and in some sense or another in leadership positions in al-Qaeda, particularly al-Qaeda in Yemen, and they've been targeted and killed. And this obviously raises an entirely different issue so that the crawl line on, you know, cable television doesn't say drone kills al-Qaeda leader. It says, should drones kill Americans? And even if these Americans are also al-Qaeda leaders, it does raise a different kind of consciousness in this country because they're American citizens. They are not necessarily people living on a farm somewhere in Iowa, but they are American citizens, and theoretically they should have some sort of due process that we wouldn't accord to the average al-Qaeda leader.
Well, answer this then. If George W. Bush were president and the position of the United States government was they can use these attacks on American citizens linked to al-Qaeda, where would the left be? What would the left be doing? What kind of demonstrations would you have? What kind of outrage would you be hearing from Democratic members of Congress?
I think you'd be hearing a lot more than Ron Wyden. Yeah. You'd be hearing a great number of Democrats outraged about it if it were George W. Bush. The left, however, and I wouldn't necessarily define very many members of the United States Congress as really being part of the left, maybe Bernie Sanders from Vermont and a few others. But
well, Alan West told me there were a lot of communists.
Yes, yeah. Alan West, I think, had counted the number of communists, and it turned out to be exactly the number of people who were in the Democrats' progressive caucus in the House. But let's just say that there is a left beyond the Democratic Party, and that left, which can be read in the blogs and which can be found, you know, in a lot of different places and does organize and have events, that left has been extremely critical of President Obama on the drones and on many aspects of the way he's conducted foreign policy. They don't see him as having been at all true to the principles that got him the Nobel Prize before he was really even the president United States.
Peace Prize.
The Nobel Prize for Peace.
Yeah.
And they see him as being an enormous hypocrite on these things. So the left has been, I think, pretty consistent. But the members of the Democratic Party in Congress, not so much. They haven't by any means given him the criticism that George W. Bush would have gotten for the same policies.
So it's too soon to say how this will affect the Brennan nomination. Of course, Brennan has been the counterterrorism advisor to President Obama all these years.
Largely responsible for this drone program.
But it seems like with all these editorials from mainstream newspapers around the country demanding more information, it seems like the administration is willing to give at least the Intelligence Committee some of the background, some of the justification for these policies, and we'll just see how it affects, if at all, the Brennan nomination.
And let's also recognize the fact that there are few things that we have done in the whole war on terror that have more support from the American people than the idea of selected or surgical strikes by unmanned aircraft, drones, that take out people we are at least at this point convinced were al-Qaeda leaders plotting things against the United States. And it is a minority view that this is hurting the United States in the long run with the Islam community around the world. I think the majority view in this country is if we can get these guys without having to send our people over there, without having to invade countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, let's do it.
Okay, but in fairness, there have been 3,500 deaths caused by these drone attacks. Many, I don't know how many, but there have been women and children
and innocents.
So sure, it's popular in the U.S., and let's do it whatever we can to stop terrorism without sending in troops, but there are consequences that need to be addressed.
Well, and speaking of outrages that have caused a lot of international concern, I understand that Geraldo Rivera is going to run for the Senate in New Jersey.
That is scary. That is frightening. And it's almost reason enough to keep Frank Lautenberg, who's going to be 90 years old. Frank Lautenberg, in the fourth quarter of 2012, raised a total of $11,000, which makes one
all wonder, in one night?
Well, it makes him wonder if he's going to run again. He's probably not going to run again. But it's funny how people like now Geraldo Rivera, before that Lou Dobbs of CNN and Fox fame, were always talking about running for the Senate in New Jersey, but they never do that. We don't have enough Fox celebrities running for the Senate.
No, I agree. There should be more people from Fox running in New Jersey. But will Jerry Rivers really actually run there in New Jersey, which is the name by which he went in high school?
Of course not. Just the way Chris Matthews was always talking about running for the Senate in Pennsylvania because he wanted to be part of the conversation until he realized that, one, nobody cared, and two, he wouldn't have a job on MSNBC. So just like Rivera won't run, just like Chris Matthews won't run, even I won't run for the Senate from New Jersey.
Well, but not everybody who could run for that Senate seat in New Jersey is going to run for it.
No, that's true. I mean, Chris Christie, the very popular governor of New Jersey, who's up for re-election this year, is not going to run for the Senate. And
Is he not running for the Senate?
Well, you know, you saw him on the Letterman show actually eating a jelly donut in the middle of the interview.
That was so cruel.
But it wasn't cruel because it leads on to his appearance next week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But another person not from New Jersey, and perhaps not even from Kentucky, is Ashley Judd. Of course, she is born in Kentucky. Her family's been in Kentucky a million years. But she's more recently from the state of Tennessee. And that's part of this amazing spoof of an ad from American Crossroads.
Again, the Karl Rove group we talked about earlier.
Mocking Ashley Judd as a potential Democratic candidate against Mitch McConnell for the Senate in Kentucky.
You know what this country really needs? An independent voice for Obama.
I am committed to President Obama and Vice President Biden. I think he's a brilliant man. He is now able to flower more as the president I knew he could be.
A leader who knows how to follow.
I will go wherever the president wants me to go.
Someone who will never forget where she came from.
And it just clicked. Tennessee is home. And it just clicked.
Kentucky
is home.
Someone who knows what's good for us. Ashley Judd. An Obama-following radical Hollywood liberal who's right at home here in Tennessee. Kentucky.
God!
Oh, man.
Oh, I don't know if it's ever been done more effectively.
Well, it may be so effective that there's no way in the world she runs. And that's
That's odd. Is that really what they're trying to do here? Just keep her out of the race because they actually think she might be an effective candidate?
No, anybody who's a big Obama booster in a state like Kentucky, where President Obama did very poorly in 2012, is not going to be a threat, I think, to Mitch McConnell, who I think is vulnerable. He never wins by big margins.
You mean vulnerable in November as opposed to the primary, where most Republicans are vulnerable if they're vulnerable at all.
No, he's had some tough races against Democrats in the past, maybe 52-53%, which is not landslide proportions, shall we say.
Not in our time.
No, and so I kind of think that perhaps the worst thing this ad could do for the Republicans is keep Ashley Judd out of the race.
Before we go, we have to tip our hats to the passing of one of the most colorful political characters of our lifetime, perhaps of anyone's lifetime, certainly of his lifetime, Ed Koch.
Well, you know something, I mean, having lived in New York City and the New York City area during his mayoralty.
Ken, you were living in the New York area at some point in your life? In the general Yankee world?
Well, we did flee New York during the John Lindsay years. So I was in New Jersey when Ed Koch was elected mayor in 1977. But let me tell you about New York City in 1977. It was on the brink of financial ruin. Koch was really a dye-in-the-wood liberal, anti-Vietnam, anti-Nixon, a really progressive left-wing member of Congress.
Right up against Bella Abzug.
Bella Abzug, Abe Beame, and Mario Cuomo, all in that primary, along with Herman Badillo. And I mean, everybody was in that 1977 primary. Koch was not supposed to win it, but he did because he was honest, he was refreshing, he spoke his mind, and New Yorkers loved him. So he was elected in 1977 and then was reelected in 1981 with Democratic and Republican nominations. But he did take a detour in 1982, deciding to run for governor.
In the Democratic primary.
Who was then lieutenant governor. And he despised Mario Cuomo. Remember in 1977, when all the rumors about Ed Koch's sexuality were out there, there were posters everywhere in the city.
Vote for Cuomo, not the homo.
I mean, it was everywhere. And there was a very interesting New York Times interview with Ed Koch that was just released a few days ago that was not supposed to be released until his death, that talked about how Ed Koch felt about Mario Cuomo and Andrew Cuomo. It's brutal to the end of his life.
When he ran against Cuomo for the governor's nomination in 1982, and Cuomo was already lieutenant governor, was he not running intentionally to split the New York City vote and in some sense or another do Mario in?
Well, first of all, Cuomo was very popular upstate. He visited all those upstate cities as Hugh Carey's lieutenant governor. And another thing, Ed Koch had this interview in Playboy magazine where he completely derided upstate vote life, like it was sterile and ridiculous. And so he insulted everybody upstate north of Westchester. And a lot of New Yorkers loved Ed Koch so much they didn't want him to leave for governor, so they didn't vote for him either. So Cuomo won pretty sizably.
Easily in the primary.
Unexpectedly. But Koch eventually did recover, won a landslide re-election in 1985. But at the same time, New York City was changing. Ed Koch was changing, too. He went from this progressive Greenwich Village liberal to a more conservative guy. He was pro-death penalty. He would talk about entitlements as if they didn't deserve them. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of racial antagonism building in New York City that was culminated in the 1989 primary when he lost to David Dinkins, who became the first black mayor in New York City history.
Ed Koch died Friday morning, February 1st, at the age of 88. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.